Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 14th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, pictures of a nearby star reveal three planets in a kind of scaled-up solar system. The discovery of naturally occurring blue-green algae that don't produce oxygen, and the evolution of human childhood. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
About 130 light-years away is a star astronomers call HR8799 that has three planets orbiting it. That's not what's remarkable. Hundreds of planets have been discovered orbiting other stars. But astronomers typically infer the existence of planets by a number of techniques, such as how the star dims when the planet passes in front of it or how it varies in its radial velocity with respect to Earth. This discovery is unique because it's the first direct image, a picture, of a multi-planet system, and seeing is believing. In a paper published online by Science, Christian Marat and colleagues describe the planetary system, a kind of scaled-up solar system, but much younger than ours. HR 8799 is only about 60 million years old, whereas our solar system is more than 4 billion years old. I spoke with Marat from his office at the NRC Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada.
So we use direct imaging. So using the Gemini Keck telescope, we use what we call an adaptive optic system to correct from the turbulence for the atmosphere, and as well an infrared camera, because these objects are very cool, they're very cold. So most of their brightness or their luminosity is in the infrared. So essentially, you point a telescope toward the star and you actually take an image of the system with a camera.
Where are these planets?
Well, the three planets are found around the star HR 8799. So that star is found in the constellation of Pegasus. And it's roughly at 130 light years from us.
Out of all the stars, why did you and your team decide to look for planets there?
Well, that star is very peculiar. First of all, it's an A star. It's a bit more massive than the Sun, and it's five times as luminous. And there was actually two points that was very attracting. One, it has a known dust disk rotating at roughly 80 AU from the star. That's a sign that planet formation has occurred or is occurring. And it's also very young, roughly 60 million years. So that's important because planets do not produce any energy. They don't burn hydrogen like the Sun. They just cool down with time. So if you can find a star that's really young, so the planets are still very hot and luminous, these are easier to detect by direct imaging.
In these images, what does the planetary system look like?
Well, the three planets are located at roughly 25, 40, and 70 astronomical units. So an astronomical unit is the average distance between the Sun and Earth. So they're roughly fairly far away from the star, similar to the other planets of our own solar system, like Uranus and Neptune.
So it sounds like this is a scaled-up version of our solar system?
Yes, exactly. So this system is probably around twice as big as our solar system. And of course, the planets are much more massive. They're roughly 7 Jupiter mass, and the two inner planets are 10 Jupiter mass. So these are a much more massive version of our solar system.
If this is a scaled-up version, which planets would these three resemble in terms of distance from our sun, say?
Well, in terms of distance, the inner one would be roughly the distance of Neptune and Uranus, while the most distant one was actually twice the distance of Pluto. And in terms of mass and appearance, they would look like a Jupiter or a more massive Jupiter.
So could there be perhaps other smaller planets closer in that you just can't see?
Yeah, with the direct imaging technique, we're currently severely limited at smaller angular separation. So we can't tell if there's any more planets inside the 25 AU planet, the inner one that we've discovered. But yeah, there's definitely enough room in there to have more planets, or maybe terrestrial or rocky planets.
Is that what is expected for such a young star system?
Okay, usually the planet formation occurs in tens of million years. So at 60 million years, this is probably standard. But of course, we don't know a lot of system at that age. So it's still an open question. What exactly is the time scale for planet formation? And that's, I'm hoping that this discovery will be able to give us more insight in that problem.
How long have you and your team been observing this planetary system?
We discovered a planetary system using Gemini data in October 2007. But we'll be able to recover old images that have really short sequences, and we'll be able to reprocess this data with better algorithm. So we have essentially four-year baseline to detect orbital motion of these planets. So essentially we have data dating 2004.
With all of that data, is it possible that it's something other than planets orbiting this larger type A star?
So we believe that these three objects are planets and not brown dwarf being a failed star in between planet and star in mass, because the three objects are really faint for the estimated age of the system, roughly 60 million years old. For these three objects to be brown dwarf, the system would need to be more than 300 million years old.
Now, you said this was a very special star, HR 8799. Does that make this nearby planetary system something similarly unique, or will there be many more announcements in the near future about planets relatively nearby around other stars?
Well, the star is really unique, so you could say that this was probably a diamond in the rough, because it's, first of all, it has a very massive disk, one of the most massive ever detected for nearby stars. So you could say that that disk was the origin of forming these planets, that it could be a really unique star. But the real answer will have to come from an extensive survey that we're currently performing at the Gemini, Keck, and VLT telescope to look at a large number of these A stars to look for planets.
What else might be learned about these planets then?
Well, what we currently have done on this system is photometry. The next step would be to do spectroscopy of this planet, because spectroscopy, you can learn a lot more about the detailed physics of these atmospheres, learn more about their composition, the detailed molecular composition, better characterization of the temperature and possibly mass when you compare with models. Because these objects being in between what we call the LT transition, L object between very dusty atmosphere, possessing very dusty atmosphere, and T object having clear atmosphere. So understanding how that process becoming from L to T is a very interesting subject of research. And these objects are very close to that transition. So detailed study of these atmospheres will be able to give more information on this physical process. The next step is, of course, understanding a bit more about how planets form around star, because these are probably the first directly imaged multi-planet system around another star, and they all seem to be orbiting in the same counterclockwise orbital orientation, meaning that they're probably formed inside a protoplanet that's similar to the how the planets in our solar system have formed. So understanding this system will give us a better understanding how our solar system has formed.
These were all ground-based telescopes. Is it possible that there's better data that could be captured by space-based telescopes or other telescope methods that are coming online?
Yeah, I'm currently in a team that are building what's called the Gemini Planet Imager for the Gemini telescope. And this is a next-generation adaptive optics system to better correct the turbulence from the atmosphere, as well as much more advanced instrumentation that's going to use what we call a coronagraph to interfere destructively the light from the star. And that will enable us to see planets that are much fainter and much closer in than what we can currently do with instrumentation that's currently available at the telescope. So pointing that new instrument that should become available in the next 3 years, we'll be able to look for planets around other stars, but as well as looking for planets in the inner region of HR 8799.
Christian Marois, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Christian Marois is lead author of a paper on direct imaging of multiple planets orbiting the star HR 8799. You can read the paper and another paper about imaging a single planet orbiting a star 25 light years away, as well as a related perspective online at www.scienceexpress.org. Now that Barack Obama is set to become the U.S. president, he will spend the next 2 months preparing for the responsibilities that lie ahead. To help him do that, he has put together a transition team. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
Among the team's tasks is to help the president-elect choose individuals for high-level posts in the executive branch. One such appointment that excites the interest of the scientific community is the White House Science Advisor. During the campaign, Obama had a group of scientists to advise him on matters of science policy, including Nobel laureates Harold Varmus and Peter Agre, as well as former AAAS president Gilbert Omen, astrophysicist Don Lam, and biologist Sharon Long. There is speculation that some of those same people are under consideration for the job of science advisor in the new administration. The question is not just who the appointee will be, but when he or she will be named. President Bush waited 5 months before naming John Marburger as his science advisor in 2001. That won't do in 2009, according to a group of nearly 180 organizations led by AAAS and the Association of American Universities. They have asked that the science advisor be appointed in time for the January 20th inauguration, arguing that he or she could provide crucial expertise needed to address energy, health care, national security, and other top priorities for Obama. Of course, the presidential election wasn't the only race that took place on November 4th. Democrats made gains and will continue to hold a majority in both chambers of Congress. There are a few new representatives with science and technology backgrounds, bringing the total to 47 members, according to Scientists and Engineers for America.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. For more information on the transition, visit election2008.aaas.org. Scientists may need to rethink the carbon and nitrogen cycles in the ocean, which in turn could have enormous implications for accurately modeling climate change. That's because of the recent discovery of unicellular nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria. Nitrogen fixing is important for both biological productivity and the carbon flux in the oceans, and the cyanobacteria, or blue-green algae, is typically defined as one that generates its own food through photosynthesis, taking carbon out of the atmosphere and producing oxygen. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, John Zayer and colleagues describe an abundant type of these unicellular nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria that do not photosynthesize and so do not take carbon out of the atmosphere. I spoke with Zayer from California, where he works in the Ocean Sciences Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
Well, I've been studying the role of microorganisms in ocean ecology for a long time, and I have been investigating a particular type of microorganism, specifically a cyanobacterium or blue-green algae, that has the ability to fix nitrogen. In other words, it can use nitrogen gas from the air to make biological material. This is the same thing that goes on with legumes and crops. Bacteria and legumes can fix nitrogen, so it's an important fertilization process. Anyway, I've been studying this organism. I found the genes for it, so I knew it was there, and I was trying to understand how it worked, and this paper reports our ability to sequence its genome without actually bringing it into culture, and the surprising thing was it's very different from all the other cyanobacteria that have previously been characterized in that it has a very different mode of photosynthesis. Specifically, it lacks what's called photosystem II component, which is one of the major components of photosynthesis in higher plants and the blue-green algae.
What does it mean more precisely that it's lacking this photosystem II?
What it means is the photosystem II is the part of photosynthesis which results in the evolution of oxygen or the release of oxygen from the photosynthetic reaction. That's the process which has created oxygen in our atmosphere. In fact, it was cyanobacteria and this what's called oxygenic photosynthesis, which has resulted in the oxygen that we breathe. That occurred over a billion years ago. And so all cyanobacteria that we know about, as well as higher plants, have had this mode of photosynthesis that evolves oxygen. And now here we've discovered this microorganism, which for some reason or another has lost the ability of that part of the photosynthetic reaction. It can still presumably harvest energy from light, but it can't catalyze the release of oxygen from water.
So this cyanobacteria just uses photosystem one, and
it has been shown that bacteria can primarily use photosystem one under certain conditions, but there's never been a cyanobacterium which has been shown to completely lack the photosystem II. And what that means is that instead of being an organism that can live on very simple elements and can fix carbon dioxide from the air to make its own sugars, this organism is dependent on other organisms. So it not only cannot catalyze this particular part of the reaction of photosynthesis, but it also cannot fix its own carbon. And so it is dependent on other organisms for existence.
Does it live in some sort of symbiotic relationship?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And so now this finding is provoking us to try to find if it's possible that it has been living in association with something that we have just not been able to observe. Again, this is not a cultured organism, so we know what size it is, but we don't know what it looks like. So we can't really look at it under a microscope or even go hunting for it by conventional microscopy. We have to go hunting for it by looking for genes or DNA or RNA or some sort of a molecular biochemical marker, which makes it harder.
Is it because the system in which it lives is too complicated to replicate in the lab that you can't culture it? Or
yeah, this is a traditional question and problem with marine microorganisms. It turns out that many marine microorganisms we have difficulty in culturing, and we don't exactly know why. There's many times many different reasons. We don't know exactly what it is they need. The conditions in the laboratory have too many contaminants from human activities, like using trace metals in a lot of our industrial applications, and that contaminates things in the lab. And so there's multiple different reasons. But it's a characteristic of marine microorganisms that we have not been able to cultivate a very large fraction of them. So it's very interesting now that we know that this organism is dependent on other organisms. First of all, that may give us clues that help us to provide the right conditions to culture it. But also it's a very interesting question as to whether or not it's symbiotic with other algae in the ocean, what kind of algae they are, and how that symbiosis exists. But most of our data so far suggests that it's a free-living organism, and so we have a real paradox or enigma here, and it's going to be very exciting whatever the answer is.
Now, is this cyanobacteria found in all the oceans?
It's found in, so again, it's we're kind of limited in data, but we've been looking for the genes for it for a number of years in a number of different oceans. And so as far as we can tell, it's pretty widespread in tropical and subtropical waters in the open ocean. It's not found, most nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria are not found in temperate or cold waters, but in the tropical and subtropical belt, it can often be very abundant and sometimes more abundant than any of the other nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria.
What does that mean in terms of the process and the amount of nitrogen-fixing in general?
Well, we're still trying to figure that out. And again, it's a difficult problem since we don't have it in culture and we can't look at it and we can't isolate it. So it's a very difficult problem to figure out how much nitrogen it fixes. But since sometimes it's the most abundant thing in some stations or locations that we have studied on oceanographic expeditions, it's the most abundant organism and probably accounts for the rates of nitrogen fixation that we measure, it looks like it can potentially contribute a large fraction of the nitrogen fixation in the oceans. And nitrogen fixation in the oceans is one of the major fuels for carbon fixation in the oceans.
John Zare, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
John Zare is lead author of a paper on nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria that lack the oxygenic photosystem II. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, how a termite digests wood. Yuichi Hongo and colleagues describe in a paper the biochemistry in the termite's gut that may lead to better methods for making biofuels, particularly cellulosic biofuels. The team sequenced the complete genome of CFPT1-2, a bacterium which accounts for 70% of the bacterial cells in one species of termite, commonly known as the super termite, because of its ability to use wood as its sole source of food. The bacteria live inside a protozoan that, in turn, lives inside the termite's gut. The genome sequence reveals that the bacteria can fix atmospheric nitrogen, recycle nitrogen from waste products, and make amino acids for both themselves and for their protozoan hosts. Read all about it in this week's Science. Compared with apes, we humans depend on our parents for a long time. After being weaned around age 2, we can't survive on our own until about age 6, depending on parents or others for food. Then, later on, we're the only species that stretch out the teenage years, having a final growth spurt and typically delaying reproduction until about 6 years after puberty. In this week's Science, contributing correspondent Anne Gibbons writes about when our long childhood developed and the evolutionary advantage it appears to have given us.
Humans are unusual for having such long childhoods. We stay in a developmental phase longer than other mammals. And this story is about when did our ancestors evolve this strategy, this what is known as a life history strategy, to take a long time to grow up. And why did they evolve this strategy? I'm very interested in that question of when did childhood get so long in our past.
How does our long period of development compare with other species?
Well, big brain, large-bodied mammals live slow and die old. In other words, it takes them a long time to grow up in general. Primates, specifically, take even longer to grow up. And then humans are even longer, so we're really unusual for having particularly long childhoods. It takes us twice as long to grow up as chimpanzees or bonobos or gorillas, And the definition of growing up in adulthood is the age of first reproduction, what the average age is. So if you look at the data for other primates, for chimpanzees, for example, they end up having their first young on average at about age 11.5. That's when they begin to have their first offspring, and that's pretty similar for gorillas and bonobos. Humans, if you look at all the hunter-gatherers and traditional populations around the globe, don't have their first babies on average until about age 19.3. And actually, there's a global peak for age 22 when the most people have their first babies. So we take a much longer time to grow up. Where that comes in, there are two different periods where we extend our childhood. One is after the age of weaning, but before we can actually feed ourselves. When a chimpanzee or a gorilla is weaned, it is able to feed itself. It doesn't need an adult for its survival at that point. There might be a little provisioning, but in humans, we wean early at about age 2, whereas chimpanzees wean around age 4. We wean at age 2, and as any parent would know, your child is not going to be able to feed itself or take care of itself at age 2, and probably not until age 6 or 7. And then the other time of extension is the teenage years, after we've passed through puberty, but before we hit the age of first reproduction when most people begin to reproduce. There's another long period there that we're still developing.
Does that longer development have to do with a longer lifespan?
Yes, it does. Not only do we extend our childhoods, we also extend our lives. But as you know, we're not the only species that have long lifespans. So do elephants, and so do chimpanzees, but they start reproducing much earlier than we do.
So what are researchers doing to try to figure out why we humans have developed or evolved to have such a long childhood compared to other species?
Well, they're looking at fossil human ancestors to try to see, okay, when did they begin to look more like us? And the first place they're looking is for fossils of children to see how quickly they grew up. And originally, researchers thought maybe they grew up on our schedule when they found the famous Tong child, an Australopithecine that lived about 2 million years ago. Raymond Dart assumed pretty much that it grew up on a human schedule. And the way he did that is, most parents know that if you look at the first molars when they erupt in children, that's often around age 6 in modern humans. He assumed then, because the first molars were erupting in the Tong child, that it was about 6 years old. Well, later researchers came in and said, wait a minute, you can go into the teeth and you can look at them under a very powerful electron microscope. And like tree rings, you can count lines where the enamel is laid down each week. They are actually like a clock. And they found that, no, it didn't take 6 years for this Tong child to have its first molars erupt. Instead, it was more like 3 or 4 years old, which is a life history strategy or a childhood of development timing that is more like a chimpanzee. So that was a huge eye-opener in the mid-80s that Australopithecines that lived 2 million years ago grew up more like a chimpanzee than a modern human. So that opened up a whole new field of research where researchers were looking at the teeth of children of other species that have lived more recently to time when they grew up. Homo erectus that came onto the scene 1.8 million years ago, Neanderthals that were around until 30,000 years ago, and the earliest members of our species. So they've been looking at their teeth, even with high-energy particle accelerators, synchrotron accelerators that give them very powerful x-rays to see daily lines laid down, so even more precise methods for counting teeth.
So with all that evidence, over what time period did our species evolve from one that lived fast and died young to one that lived slow and died old?
Well, they're closing in on the time and place. It looks like Homo erectus was living a much slower life. It's interesting. Homo erectus looks like us. It's tall, strapping, beginning to get a bigger brain at 1.8 million years, 1.5 million years, but it's growing up like a chimpanzee. So that means it had a very different family and social structure. It was reproducing more around age 12, 13, rather than around 19. So Homo erectus was not fully in place in a modern way. It was beginning to transition to a longer childhood, though. And then we know that by the time our species appears 200,000 years ago in Africa, that the fully modern pattern was in place 180,000 years ago. So the window of time has been narrowed to sometime between about 1.2, 1.5 million years ago and 200,000 years ago when this strategy evolved in our ancestors. So researchers are teasing that out, not just with fossil teeth, but also reconstructions of the brain size. That's an indirect measure because a large brain, while it doesn't drive the long childhood, there has to be a long childhood for it to get so big.
Why?
Because the brain actually, it's very interesting. This is kind of complex, but it's fascinating. Brains grow up very rapidly. However, to be able to handle the energetic burden for that brain to get so big, the body is small. It stays small in humans until we have that adolescent growth spurt. We stay small much longer. Partly the thinking is to be able to balance this whole energy budget. You can't be growing everything up at the same time. It's just too expensive for the mother. It requires too many calories. she's unable to support that, nor is the baby able to get that many calories. So the brain goes up first, then the body has to catch up, and then, of course, there's integration of the forebrain and other kinds of complex stuff that's happening in the brain later. So it seems that the brain took advantage of this life history strategy, that we evolved a long life history strategy first for reproductive reasons, and that just set a nice template upon which the brain was able to get larger.
So how about those reproductive advantages of waiting to become parents?
Well, it seems that mothers who delay having children to an older age have more offspring that survive. But there's a whole package that goes with that. Not only do we delay having our children till much later than chimpanzees, but we actually end up having more babies than they do that survive, even though we both stop at the same age. So let me give you a little data here. Chimpanzees start having their first babies around 11.5. We start having our first babies around age 19. We both stop in the 40s. Chimpanzees die pretty quickly after they stop. Female humans, though, have a period of menopause, and then they live long beyond they've had their last children. But we have more partly because we wean our babies earlier than chimpanzees. We wean them at age 2, whereas they wean theirs at age 4. That means we can push out more babies. We can stack them up. The only way we can do that, though, is with social support, and there's now thinking that with menopause, that means grandmothers are around who can help provision the young. So there's this elaborate family and social network structure that allows us to extend our childhood and have more babies.
What further evidence would help scientists narrow down when our long childhood evolved? Something more precise than, say, between 180,000 years and 1.5 million years ago.
Well, there are a couple studies in the works right now aiming at that question specifically. At the same time, there's some fascinating studies where they're beginning to be able to get a look at the age of weaning. There's a new method where they can look at the chemical composition in the teeth. They can see ratios of strontium and calcium in the teeth of humans, and they can figure out precisely when they were weaned. And when you begin to see the age of weaning getting younger, that would tell you this life history change has happened. They're just beginning to apply that method to fossils. So there are a number of lines of evidence where people are looking at also the pelvises of mothers to see when they are capable of delivering babies with larger brains. So there are a number of different lines of interdisciplinary research trying to get a handle on this question.
Ann Gibbons, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science contributing correspondent Ann Gibbons on the evolution of human childhood. Read her article and a related paper on the extinct Homo erectus in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Rob, we're going to talk about how killer whales pick out their favorite fish, how to say danger in bird language, and finally, how fighting fiddler crabs are dishonest with their enemies.
Well, let's start with how killer whales pick out their favorite fish. They like salmon, don't they?
They do. And the killer whales that live off the coast of Washington State have their choice between three different types of salmon: Chinook salmon, coho salmon, and sockeye salmon.
And they can tell the difference between three species?
Well, that's the surprising thing in this study, especially when you realize that these whales are swimming around in really dark and turbulent water. And if any of us caught these three salmon, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference just by eye. But somehow these whales are able to tell the difference without really seeing them.
Through their sonar, I suppose?
Right. It has to do with their sonar. And whales bounce sonar off of objects in the ocean, both to figure out where they're going, but also to locate prey. And a team of researchers wondered, is there something different about these three salmon that maybe causes these sonar waves to bounce back to the whales in different ways that would indicate different types of salmon? And indeed, that's what the researchers found. They took these different species of salmon and they immobilized them and they bounced simulated whale sonar off each of them. And what they found was that the structure of the waves that came back were much different for the Chinook salmon than for the other two types of salmon.
What accounts for that difference?
Well, the researchers think it has to do with the swim bladder, which is the organ in fish that helps them balance themselves in the water. And the swim bladder of the Chinook is about half the size of that in the other fish. And the swim bladder is responsible for 90% of the reflected sound energy. So if you have vast differences in the size of the swim bladder, you're going to get different sonar signals bouncing back to you.
Why are the killer whales seeking out this particular type of fish in the first place?
Well, the Chinook salmon have a lot more fat than the other type of salmon, which means they have a lot more calories. So when whales go after these salmon, they're getting a lot more bang for their bite, as it were.
Is this a strategy that could be used in our own fishing techniques?
Well, researchers are really excited about this because they say that it could really help people who study fish populations figure out how many fish are out there. This is a very laborious task right now, but imagine if you could just send out acoustic signals in the ocean and be able to determine how many of a specific type of fish is out there. But this research also suggests a downside, which is if the whales are really dependent on this particular type of fish, and if you have noise from other vessels that could interfere with this signal, you could be potentially damaging the killer whale's ability to find its food.
Well, from this sonar and noises of the ocean to the screeches of danger by birds, how do you say danger in bird language?
Well, Rob, different birds have different ways of saying danger. And what this study is about is it's about birds that eavesdrop on other birds. Smaller birds in particular have to be very wary of birds like raptors, which hunt them. And if you've got a lot of birds in one area, perhaps one species of bird will scream a certain type of alarm when it sees the raptor coming, and other birds can listen in for that scream or that alarm call, and they don't have to have their own sentries looking for the predator. They know that danger is approaching, and they go and hide as well.
Is that because the danger calls are similar?
Well, that's what researchers were asking in the study. They were wondering, do birds of different species recognize each other's danger calls because they sound so similar to their own danger calls? Or are the birds actually learning to understand what these calls mean and not using the similarity as a guide?
So what was the setup? How did they test that?
Well, the researchers took two kinds of birds, fairy wrens and scrub wrens. And both of these are small birds that are hunted by raptors and other large birds of prey. And what they did was they looked at two locations, a location where fairy wrens and scrub wrens live together, and a location where fairy wrens live by themselves. And in both of these populations, they played the alarm call of the scrub wren. And when they play that for the fairy wrens that live with the scrub wrens, the fairy wrens flew for cover. But when they play this alarm call for the fairy wrens that did not live near the scrub wrens, the fairy wrens just ignored it. And this indicates that the fairy wrens are actually learning what the alarm call means. Because if they were just saying, hey, it's similar to my own alarm call, the fairy wrens that lived by themselves would have responded just the same as the fairy wrens that lived with the scrub wrens.
So the learning that birds do isn't confined to learning from their own species.
Yeah, at least for danger calls, birds can really learn to interpret the language of another species.
Well, from the danger of a looming raptor to the danger of a fellow crab, why are these crabs fighting in the first place, and how are they being dishonest about it?
Well, fiddler crabs fight to defend their home. When they are near their home, other crabs will come by and sometimes challenge them for the space. But one thing that's interesting about fiddler crabs is that they have one enormous claw that they use to fight, and sometimes they lose this claw during the fight. And if so, they regrow another claw that's the same size, but it's a lot weaker than the original claw.
So they're bluffing about the strength of this newly regrown claw?
Well, that was the question in this study. Would these crabs that have a claw that maybe on some level they know is weaker continue to fight or continue to try to intimidate other crabs? And what this team did was they took a bunch of crabs, some with their original claws and some with the replicated weaker claws, and they put them in situations where they would either have to defend their homes or challenge other crabs for their homes. And what the researchers found is that the crabs with the fake claws, the ones that were looking for new homes to invade, would size up their enemies, and they would look for crabs with smaller claws, and they would challenge these crabs, even though they knew they might lose because their claw was fake, and even though the other crab's claw was smaller, it was real. They continued to challenge these crabs, even though in a fight, they would probably lose. And a lot of the time, the bluff worked, and these crabs with the smaller claws moved away. Now, the researchers also found that the crabs that were defending their homes that had these new weak claws would still try to bluff their way out of a fight if another crab tried to take its home.
Well, I would suppose that the crabs who hadn't lost their claws in the first place would also be sizing up potential competitors?
Well, there were differences in individuals in both cases, but the researchers are convinced that there is actually dishonesty going on. And now the question is this dishonesty something that's hardwired, or is it something that just happens on a case-by-case basis? And that's something these researchers plan to investigate next.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking to stories about how bleach kills bacteria, how flowers can swap genes to evolve, and finally, how the mineral kingdom has co-evolved with life. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the November 14th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.